I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Bill Cosby's main accuser confronted the 80-year-old from the witness stand in a Norristown courthouse today. It was the second time Andrea Constant testified against Cosby in front of a jury. WHYY's Bobby Allen was on hand, and he joins us now live on the line with details. And Bobby, what were the takeaways from today's testimony?
So Andrea Constant walked in the courtroom, and it was the most anticipated event of the retrial. She was wearing this bone white striking blazer. She took the witness stand and she walked prosecutors and jurors through the 2004 episode that triggered the charges. And, you know, she was asked, are you being paid to be here? And she said, no. And then the prosecutor said, then why are you here? And she said, for justice. And, you know, there weren't any, like, huge surprises necessarily. I mean, she just went over the incident that we all, you know, those of us who've been following the case very well know by now, you know, that Cosby gave her these three pills, said these will be your friends, they'll take the edge off. Then she passed out on Cosby's couch, and she says she was violated then, and that was back in early 2004.
Bobby, how did her testimony contrast from the first time she testified last year?
Well, the first time she testified over 2 days, and remember, her credibility is really crucial. The whole case basically hinges on whether the 12 jurors believe her, whether she is seen as a credible witness because she's the complainant. Her story is the reason why we're all in this courtroom today, and why, you know, everyone gathered last time as well. And you know, this time on direct examination by prosecutors, I mean, she was calm and composed, and, you know, she just, I think, you know, most people in the audience thought she did a pretty impressive job.
What's new this time in contrast to the last trial was we know the amount of the settlement, and that, did that come up in direct examination?
Yeah, it's one of the, actually the first things that the prosecutors mentioned because they want to get it out of the way quickly, and they really wanted to own it. That you're making a reference to the nearly $3.4 million that she won in a 2006 civil settlement with Cosby. And she admitted that when she went to the police after the incident first happened and, you know, investigators and prosecutors decided not to charge criminally, it was under the understanding that she would be more likely to prevail in a civil lawsuit. And the result of that civil lawsuit was this nearly $3.4 million. And it was a negotiated settlement. So there was a non-disclosure component to that settlement, but now it all has been broken open and the jurors and the whole courtroom is learning about it. But yes, that came up, and that was definitely you know, not involved. It was agreed during the last trial that that would not be on the table, that would not be discussed.
Then lastly, assess the defense team's cross-examination.
So Tom Mesereau, who's this Los Angeles-based attorney who represented Michael Jackson back in 2005, he's kind of this bulldog defense attorney, was really hammering into Constant, and especially the various statements that she has given to Canadian, Cheltenham, and other authorities, and trying to find discrepancies. You know, did she get Chinese dinner before or after the alleged assault? Did the alleged assault happen in January or March? There are a few instances, if you really apply pressure and scrutinize the statements that she has given to authorities, in which there are some disagreements with the facts. There are some issues, and he is highlighting those issues as a way to tell the jury, this woman on the stand, this complainant, this witness does not have credibility, therefore you should not believe her account of this alleged sexual assault. The biggest head-turner of the day was when Mesereau started talking about 100 pages of old emails that Constance sent many, many years ago, several of which involved this, you know, so-called pyramid scheme, where she was asking people, they even used the word pyramid in the business pitch, to give $65 to some kind of you know, strange business operation that we don't yet know the contours of, because the defense said they're going to pick that back up Monday when Constant has a chance to read these 100-plus emails she sent, you know, 15 years ago.
And we'll pick back up with you Monday as well. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
You bet. Thanks, Dave.
Undocumented immigrants in Pennsylvania, Delaware, and West Virginia without criminal convictions are more prone to arrest by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement than in any of the other 23 ICE jurisdictions in the country. That contention is substantiated in a new series of articles in ProPublica, co-published with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Joining me to lay out the case is study co-author Dale Russakoff. Dale, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
Is there a correlation between the number of arrests and the undocumented population in these three states?
Well, actually, the interesting point is that Pennsylvania, which has the largest undocumented population of any of those three states, is the 16th largest in the country. So in other words, it should be a lot lower relative to other regions than it is.
And again, it's the Philadelphia ICE office that encompasses this jurisdiction that also includes Delaware and West Virginia.
Right. Like, so regions like Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Chicago all have far larger populations of undocumented immigrants, and yet they had smaller, and in some cases much smaller, numbers of non-criminals being arrested.
Yet presumably all of those districts aforementioned, including Philadelphia, are acting in accordance with President Donald Trump, who shortly after his inauguration issued what was called an executive order enhancing public safety in the interior of the United States. Why is the Philadelphia region an outlier in terms of the number of arrests?
Well, you know, we were not allowed to interview anyone in the ICE office in Philadelphia or anyone in the national office on the record about this. So we don't have a simple, direct answer to that question. One of them, we think, is that there's a lot of pressure on the Philadelphia regional office of ICE to produce more arrests because of the ongoing tension between the city of Philadelphia and the Trump administration over Philadelphia's status as a sanctuary city. Another thing that we think is at work is that we found a lot of collaboration between state troopers who are not authorized to enforce immigration law, but informally helping ICE round up undocumented immigrants by holding people without a warrant when they stop them for a traffic infraction until ICE shows up, sometimes hours at a time, which is a practice that even the district attorney in Pittsburgh has said potentially opens them up to a lawsuit for violating someone's right against search and seizure, the Fourth Amendment.
Are these the actions of rogue officers, or is it you're finding that it's the official policy of local or state police?
Well, we didn't find that it was the official policy, but what we were struck by is that the state police in Pennsylvania do not have any guidelines at all for how to interact with undocumented immigrants when an officer, say, stops them on the highway for a traffic infraction. We found one trooper in particular who had turned 19 people over to ICE, and that was only the numbers that we were able to find after stopping them for things as minor as, you know, having slightly tinted windows. We found that he was also stopping people who were Hispanic, who were American citizens, and demanding their papers from them.
What recourse does an undocumented immigrant have if he or she feels they've been arrested unfairly?
The only thing they can do is go into federal court and file a civil rights claim. A number of people who cases that we found out about, who were stopped under these circumstances and held for long periods of time by the state police, went into immigration court and filed a constitutional challenge. And the immigration court is a civil court, not a criminal court. And so if you allege in immigration court that your Fourth Amendment rights were violated, that doesn't matter in immigration court unless you can prove that the violation was egregious.
What alerted you to explore this issue? And as a result, what is perhaps most revealing or surprising along the way collecting this data?
Well, what alerted us was we just set out very early in the Trump administration to try to look at a way that we could write about how immigration enforcement was changing and how life in various communities in the country was changing as a result of it. But it was very, very early on. And we looked at the press releases that different ICE regions were putting out as they conducted regional operations. We found right away that the Philadelphia region stood out for this disproportionate number of people without criminal records who were being arrested. And we just thought, you know, that's really striking. We'd like to look into that. What is that like? You know, what does that feel like to be in the middle of that? What are the policies that allow that to happen? What are the factors in you know, a region that allow that to happen?
Dale Russikoff, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's ProPublica reporter Dale Russikoff. As the Republican primary for Pennsylvania's governor comes down to its final weeks, the shots being traded between Republican candidates Scott Wagner and Paul Mango have gotten increasingly harsh and increasingly personal. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that the latest ad features State Senator Scott Wagner's daughter calling out his opponent.
Scott Wagner served in the state Senate since 2014, but he and Mango are both wealthy businessmen who've each pumped $6 million into their campaigns. That's allowed them to make heavy TV ad buys, which began with positive biographical spots. The attacks started last month, and they began on policy issues. Here's a Paul Mango ad.
Scott Wagner says Pennsylvania's liberal abortion law is working just fine and sees no reason to change it.
Wagner's campaign says he has a 100% pro-life voting record. After two attack ads, Wagner responded.
No real Republicans support Mango. That's because Mango is the leading advocate for Obamacare.
Mango's campaign says that's a distortion of comments he made as a healthcare analyst and that he opposes Obamacare. Last week, Mango escalated the conflict, going beyond Wagner's policy views and attacking his character.
Meet slumlord Scott Wagner, sued for renting apartments with termites, no heat, and leaking water. Deadbeat Dad Wagner hauled into court in order to pay $800,000 in back alimony and child support.
Wagner's campaign says there was a dispute in a divorce about the size of his income, but that he never missed a child support payment. The Wagner response ad featured his daughter Catherine speaking directly into the camera.
Paul Mango is a disgrace. Mango is taking a decade-old dispute and twisting the truth. Mr. Mango, you're not half the man my father is. Take down your disgusting ads and apologize.
Attacks on character and record sometimes occur in races where candidates have similar policy views and have to draw distinctions in other ways. Are there sharp policy differences between Wagner and Mango?
Well, they would have you believe that there are.
John Delano is a columnist for the Pittsburgh Business Times who teaches public policy at Carnegie Mellon University.
But I haven't seen any direct evidence that they are anything but the conservatives that they claim to be.
Of course, Wagner and Mango aren't the only candidates in the race.
I don't think the governor's office is for sale.
Laura Ellsworth is a high-powered attorney and civic leader in Pittsburgh. She doesn't have the personal wealth to bankroll the ads Mango and Wagner have, but she says that's not how most voters want to pick the next governor.
I don't think anybody wants it to go to the highest bidder. I think they want it to go to the person who shows the character and leadership and focus on the issues that impact real people.
Ellsworth hasn't yet placed TV ads, which are the quickest way to become known in this sprawling state. She says she'll be on TV later in the campaign when voters are more focused. Delano says if the air wars between Mango and Wagner continue, it could help Ellsworth on primary day.
If you're a Republican voter, you'll see three names on the ballot, and two of them are men who are essentially attacking each other day and night. You just might opt for that third person who's on the ballot who hasn't engaged in any of that stuff.
What's ahead? Mango spokesman Matt Bainan says his campaign has no plans to take down the ad calling Wagner a deadbeat dad, and he says there's more rough stuff coming, including a spot which portrays Wagner as a violent, unhinged individual going back decades. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
And the winner of the May 15th Republican primary will face incumbent Democratic Governor Tom Wolf. The calendar is kind to procrastinators this year. Taxes are not due until Tuesday. Let's pay the bill with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, let's start with the obvious. Nobody likes paying taxes, right?
Well, 45% of Americans say that the amount of taxes that they pay is too high. Last year, it was slightly over 50% who said the amount of taxes they pay is too high. So we're actually down modestly in the percent of Americans who are complaining about their taxes this year. Whether that's due or not to the tax reform bill, which was signed into law just before the end of last year, it's a little more difficult to tell from the data. I can say that Americans right now are still negative about the tax bill. Roughly 4 out of 10 Americans say they approve, but more than that, upwards of a half of Americans say they disapprove, and those numbers really aren't different from what we've been seeing. But I should say, and I think this is one of the most important questions in the poll that we just finished, 55% of Americans say they don't know yet whether this tax reform bill is going to help them or hurt them tax-wise. So for a lot of Americans, the jury's still out on what the ultimate impact's going to be.
Say, Frank, are you willing to flip the table, as it were, for a moment and ask a series of potentially embarrassing questions about your Facebook account?
I don't have a Facebook account, so you can ask away.
You are certainly not in the majority in that regard.
That's right. A little more than half, 55% of Americans say they have a Facebook page, so I'm in the minority, the 45% there, in terms of Facebook having a Facebook page. Of course, that doesn't mean you use it just because you have a page. But germane to everything we've seen this week, with CEO and founder Mark Zuckerberg testifying before the Senate and then the House, we have Americans concerned about privacy going up from 2011. Maybe not as high as some people would think. 43%, that's the number. 43% of Facebook users say that they are very, and I would emphasize very, concerned about invasion of privacy. And that's up from 30%. In 2011, who were very concerned about invasion of privacy. And again, we're talking here about Facebook users.
Frank, we don't and likely won't know how concerned Robert Mueller is about holding on to his position. What do Americans think about that probe going forward?
A lot of Americans don't have an opinion on Robert Mueller yet, maybe because they don't know what he's going to find, as you alluded to. But our numbers show 36% of Americans have a favorable opinion and 28% an unfavorable opinion. Of course, when we ask about Donald Trump, it's a flip of that. He has right now 38% favorable, 59% unfavorable ratings. So Americans are more positive about Mueller than they are about Trump. But when you look internally, of course, it's very political. Republicans, favorable on Trump, unfavorable on Mueller. Democrats, very favorable on Mueller, unfavorable on Trump.
As you mentioned Trump, are there numbers on Melania?
Yes, she's doing better than her husband. You know, we found Hillary Clinton, of course, did very well in our data back when her husband, Bill Clinton, was being impeached in 1998 and then tried in the Senate in 1999. Those were, in fact, her highest favorable numbers of any time that we've measured Hillary Clinton. Melania is not as positive as that, but she's net positive, 47 positive, 36% negative image in the part of the American public, 47-36. And again, that's not hugely positive, but certainly a lot better than her husband, who's unfavorable, as we've just talked about, is up near 60%.
Does that pattern hold for most presidencies? I'm sure Michelle often had higher ratings than her husband, President Barack Obama.
It does. Most first ladies are not controversial because they're not doing something highly controversial. I mean, Hillary Clinton's favorable ratings suffered some when she was actually actively involved in the government as first lady back in 1993-94, when, as you remember, she headed up the administration's efforts on reforming the health care system in this country. But generally speaking, first ladies do better than their husbands overall because they're not on the firing line, right? And that's true right now with First Lady Melania Trump.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. This weekend, a theater festival in Philadelphia will present monologues written by teens. The Mouthful Festival is produced by Philadelphia Young Playwrights, now celebrating 30 years of teaching kids to write. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the young writers will have their works brought to life by professional actors.
One of the monologues in the Mouthful Festival is written from the perspective of the city of Philadelphia, as though the city was a character on stage.
It knows its problems, it knows how they need to be fixed, but it also knows its citizens and what the city looks like when it's lit up, like in a beautiful way.
That is the author, Tyler Riddick. She's a senior at the U School in North Philadelphia, and she wrote about gun violence, where the city chastises its residents for using bullets to settle squabbles. She was driven to write the piece after a friend of hers was caught in a crossfire. He was killed.
I found out over social media, so it hit me in a way like I really didn't believe it at first until the funeral where I saw his body in the casket. And he was only 16.
Riddick wrote the piece called Restore My Brotherly Love as part of Philadelphia Young Playwrights. Its director is Lisa Nelson Haynes, who says there's nothing new about teenagers with strong feelings or the ability to articulate them.
You know, I remember seeing something on Facebook the weekend after Parkland. A friend of mine said, "Who's putting these kids up here to say these things?" You know, after the kids started speaking out. And I became enraged because I was like, no one has to put them up there. They just need to be offered the forum and the vehicle.
There will be 18 monologues presented in the Mouthful Festival with topics ranging from discrimination to gender identity to catcalling to the anxiety of ordering at a fast food counter. After the festival, they will all be rolled out over the next few months as podcasts. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Finally this evening, it is Friday the 13th, also known as Black Friday for tattoo parlors everywhere. Ouch! All across the country, shops are offering cheap deals on specialty designs, which usually incorporate the number 13. And Josh Teague, who works at Electric Temple in Brewery Town, says he and the other tattoo artists design 3 sheets of discounted palm-sized tattoos for customers to choose from. He describes the designs as basically, quote, random cool ideas they want to tattoo on people.
The most eccentric on my sheet is a pig with a top hat. The most eccentric on Shanda's sheet, I would say, is a lady in a polka dot sweater smoking a cigarette.
And Teague says these discount days usually draw triple the number of customers into the shop, and he expects to be tattooing very late into the night. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. Assistant news director, Katie Colinari. John Mussoni is assistant vice president for news operations. At the helm this week, Al Banks, Bob Alls, Charlie Kyer, Diana Martinez, and Adam Stanishevsky. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.
Villanova University's Sustainable Engineering Program supports WHYY, offering a part-time or full-time master's program and PhD. The Sustainable Engineering degree can be earned online or on campus and is appropriate for engineers and non-engineers alike. Villanova's interdisciplinary graduate program weaves theory and case studies with team project experience to explore the full environmental, social, and economic aspects of sustainable engineering. Details at vusustainableengineering.com.
Mercy Accountable Care supports WHYY. Mercy Accountable Care provides primary care physicians with tools designed to help them succeed in providing value-based care. Population health data, evidence-based strategies, and a multidisciplinary support team help identify opportunities to improve patient care and outcomes while reducing costs, so physicians can share savings and reinvest to strengthen their practices for the future. Learn more at mercyhealth.org/ACO.
The Morris Arboretum supports WHYY and welcomes spring with a celebration of the Japanese Cherry Blossom Festival on Saturday, April 14th with live drummers, traditional Japanese tea demonstrations, origami workshops, kimono dressing, and more. Guided walks of Morris Arboretum's ornamental cherry collection are offered on Saturday. Located in Chestnut Hill, spring is in bloom at Morris Arboretum. Details at morrisarboretum.org.